MacCast, Sunday, July 17th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Back here with you for another week of coverage of Apple and Macintosh stuff. Hope you've been having a great week or had a great past week. Got a lot of good things to get into in this episode. We're going to be talking a little bit about some of Apple's new acquisitions, specifically one of them, and that is Shazam. You may have heard that news already. We're going to dive into that. We're also going to talk about some new subscription pricing that is available to developers when they're selling apps on the Mac App Store. Going to talk about the airport update that we received this week that we didn't think we needed. Get into what that's all about. Also, probably the big news of the week, the iMac Pro is here. So we'll get into some of the details surrounding that. Also, investments that Apple's been making recently in future iPhone technology, and also more on Apple's original video content efforts. We have all of that in the news. Plus, we're going to get into some of your feedback and additional tips and tricks and things like that, including File Vault. We talked a little bit about that in the last episode, and you had some questions surrounding that. We're going to talk about some issues I've been having with getting support at Apple and just bigger things surrounding that. Someone wants to know about nagging software updates and maybe how to get those to be a little bit more quiet. So I'm going to give you a tip on that. We've got some great Safari tips and tricks coming up and a pretty little neat thing of the moment if you are an iPhone X user. So stay tuned for all of that. We're going to jump right into the first story, kicking things off with Apple acquiring a little company called Shazam that you may be familiar with. If you're not, Shazam is an app and a service that allows your device to listen to a segment of music, something from a TV show, and identify it for you. And if you've ever used Safari's feature to help you identify a piece of music, Shazam is the technology that drives that. Well, we mentioned on the last episode of the MacCast that TechCrunch had a rumor that Apple might be looking to acquire Shazam this week. They announced that, yep, that's exactly what they did, though they didn't disclose any of the terms of the deal. Now, you may remember TechCrunch said that their source had indicated the deal was worth around $400 million. Back in 2015, Shazam as a company was actually valued at around $1 billion. So seems like the price came down for Apple. So maybe they got a little bit of a deal on Shazam. As far as what their plans for it are exactly, we don't really know. But in their statement, Apple said, quote, Apple Music and Shazam are a natural fit, sharing a passion for music discovery and delivering great music experiences to our users. So I think it's no stretch of the imagination to imagine that they're going to integrate it somehow with Apple Music, but I have a feeling they have bigger plans for that as well. Maybe more stuff integrated into Siri and possibly maybe the HomePod. Who really knows? Now, Shazam is also built into a lot of competing products and services from Apple's, you know, things like Snapchat, the Samsung smart TVs use the technology. I think even Spotify has integration with Shazam. So we don't know what the future of those relationships are either. If Apple's going to continue to sell Shazam services to those third parties, I would imagine not, at least not in the long run. In the short term, they don't seem to be making any quick changes. And Shazam does make some money from purchases and things driven through those other applications. So it is a revenue stream. And I guess it all comes down to what Apple's plans for the technology are. And we're really not going to know that in any other way other than to wait and see what they do with it. But Apple did acquire Shazam this week. Looks like Apple is planning to give developers some more options when they sell subscriptions inside their apps. And what they're adding in and have announced to developers through the Apple Developer News page is introductory pricing as well as free trial subscriptions, something they didn't have before, as a marketing tool. There's going to be three new introductory price types. They're going to have pay as you go, pay up front, which to me are very similar, and then also the free trial option. So the pay as you go, what that is that allows a developer to set an introductory price for a subscription for a set period of time, and then that would transition over to a full price. So imagine you have a service like that's going to cost, say, $9.99 a month. They could offer up that service the first 3 months at $4.99, and then it'll switch over to $9.99 after that. So each payment. Now, the pay up front, which again sounds similar, lets them set one price for a preset duration before transitioning to a higher rate. So it seems more geared toward like monthly subscriptions than, say, weekly subscriptions. So say it's, a subscription that's going to be $100 a year. They could say the first 6 months are just $29.99, and then after that you pay $99 for the next year. And then finally, they have the free trial option, which is exactly like it sounds. It delays the period of time before your subscription pricing starts kicking in. It's pretty much the way that Apple Music works with its free trial, right? So you can try out the service, see if you're going to like it, and then if you do, then your subscription kicks in and you start paying, but you get full access to all the features during that trial period. And I guess in a way that kind of opens up, at least for subscription-based apps, a trial for the application, which is something that developers have wanted for a long time. I wish this was something that Apple had added for just regular applications, non-trial applications, but it could be a workaround or a way, I imagine, for developers to potentially move into that. Unfortunately, it's going to have to be a subscription-based app, and it seems like so many apps are moving to the subscription revenue model with iOS that this might actually force more developers to choose that option moving forward. And I'm not entirely certain how I feel about that. Whether or not that happens, we're just going to have to wait and see. But I have a feeling, you know, it really is Apple kind of pushing people in that direction. Now, developers who want to implement these new options, they do need to use the new iOS 11.2 StoreKit APIs. So they have to update to sort of Apple's latest development tools. And another thing somewhat related to this you may have heard of is Apple also announced app pre-orders being available to all developers. This was something that Apple trialed with Super Mario Run with Nintendo. If you remember, you could pre-order that app, and then when it became available, you got a notification and it automatically downloaded to your device on that day. That is now available to any developer who wants to sort of pre-sell their application. And again, that may be a great way for developers to kind of gauge demand for their product and also get a little bit of upfront revenue in advance of releasing the product, which could help for things like marketing, getting a marketing budget and maybe help them better promote the app. So I think these are good changes for the App Store. Again, I'm hoping that Apple expands them beyond just the subscription level, but I think it's a good place to start. Apple released airport firmware updates this week, 7.7.9 and 7.6.9, depending upon whether you have the latest AC Apple Airport or the older N version. And surprisingly, this update mainly addresses the key reinstallation attack or the crack attack that we heard about a few months back in October. Crack was the man-in-the-middle style hack that was revealed in October that made most Wi-Fi devices that used WPA2 protection protocols open to a packet decrypting attack. So it was pretty serious. A lot of devices and routers and things were vulnerable to this attack. The attack requires that both the client and the router be vulnerable. So Apple did quickly, if you remember, patch iOS, macOS, tvOS, and watchOS back in October, and that essentially closed up the hole, but they did not patch airport routers at that time, and many of us, myself included, I probably even reported this on the MacCast, were led to believe that Apple's airports and time capsule devices were not susceptible or not vulnerable to the key reinstallation attack, that they didn't have the exploit in them. That, as it seems obvious now, turns out not to be the case, especially with these new firmware updates that specifically address that issue on the airport. So if you own an airport or time capsule, you're going to want to ensure that you download and patch your device as soon as possible. So make sure you open up the airport utility, check for updates if you haven't already been notified of it and you haven't already updated your device. Now, another recent security update of note was also the release of iOS 11.2.1 and tvOS 11.2.1. This one addresses bugs and issues that have been discovered since the release of iOS 11.2. Most importantly, it fixes and re-enables the remote access for shared users of the Home app. You may remember that we mentioned there was an exploit, a pretty serious exploit that impacted that. Apple took the initiative immediately of shutting down that functionality from the server side. Now with the update of iOS 11.2.1 for tvOS and iOS, that has been re-enabled and it has fixed now that HomeKit vulnerability. So that HomeKit vulnerability did allow unauthorized access to HomeKit accessories for remote shared users, and they could access things like smart locks and other devices on your HomeKit network without any kind of authentication. So it was a pretty serious bug, and if you're running HomeKit at all, you probably want to make sure that that is patched up. So if you haven't grabbed the 11.2.1 updates, you're going to want to go ahead and do that now. But that's kind of the latest on some of the more serious security issues getting closed up this week. As I mentioned at the top of the show, probably the big news for this week is that the iMac Pro is now available for order, at least in a couple of configurations. Well, really all the configurations if you're talking pre-order, but if you want to get one soon, you can order up the 10 or 8 and 10 core versions. Apple has the recommended configurations on their website. They are shipping now, and it's expected that by the time you hear this podcast or within a couple days of getting this podcast, they will be available at Apple retail stores. You can also custom configure on Apple's website the 14 core and 18 core versions. I think the 14 core is relatively new. Apple, I believe, had announced a 12 core version, but it's looking like it's 14 core and 18 core. Those, though, are not going to be shipping for another 6 to 8 weeks, so not until 2018 if you want to get one of those beefier models. All of the iMac Pros come with AMD Radeon Pro Vega 64 graphics processors, and all of them are configurable with up to 128 gigabytes of RAM and up to 4 terabytes of internal SSD storage. Of course, you're going to be paying quite a price for those configurations. Pricing starts at $4,999 for that 8-core recommended model. And with all the bells and whistles, a new iMac Pro can easily run you up over $13,000. So in some cases, more than the price of a very low-cost compact car, which sounds like a lot, but in reality, and I kind of pointed to this out this week, for at least Pro Max, prices have always been about this high. If you remember, Apple's 2FX machine back in 1990, configured with a base price of about just under $9,000. And again, if you added in, it had all kinds of slots and cards, so you could add additional bells and whistles, and you could easily get it up into this 13K range. So Apple's always kind of had this price point at the higher end. And for those people who need it, there really is a business justification for it. So certainly the iMac Pro is not for everyone. It's not for your casual user. It really is designed and geared for high-end video professionals, photographers, people who are doing really high-end pro work where they need to be able to take advantage of those multi-cores, all of that RAM, all of that super fast storage. Apple also did confirm that the iMac Pro has a second generation T2 chip. You may remember the T1 chip was introduced with the new Touch Bar MacBook Pros and handles and integrates a number of features and functionality, including some of the security features. The T2 chip integrates the system management controller, the image signal processor, audio controllers, and the SSD controllers all into the hardware of that chip. It also has the secure Enclave coprocessor to handle encrypted storage and secure boot capabilities, something new to the iMac Pro. With the new boot capabilities, you can enable options through system preferences that prevent the iMac Pro from being able to be started up from a different hard disk, a CD, or a DVD without a password, or you can even disable external booting completely if you really want to lock down your system. So that is all because that extra processor can handle things during the boot process, right? And it can handle passing keys securely back and forth between the hardware. So it's pretty cool tech that's built in there. You may remember also that the iMac Pro is the first model iMac to come in a space gray color and also comes exclusively with space gray accessories, including a space gray magic trackpad, a space gray keyboard, and a space gray magic mouse. And you can choose whether you want the magic mouse or the magic trackpad when you're building out your configuration, of course, or of course you can get both of those. But again, they're going to come exclusively with the iMac Pro. Something else to note about the iMac Pro that many are considering not that pro is that it's a completely closed and non-user upgradable system. So there's not a port, there's not a door on the back to be able to get in and do your own memory upgrades. You're not going to be able to swap out the storage. So really the configuration that you buy when you purchase the iMac Pro is the configuration that you're more or less stuck with. A little caveat there on that in a second here. But as far as ports, it's got a lot of expandability built in. 4 Thunderbolt 3 USB-C ports, 4 USB 3 ports. So you've got USB-C and USB 3 as well as Thunderbolt, also an SD card slot, and the first Mac to have 10 gigabit Ethernet. Got a 10 gigabit Ethernet port built in. And then there's a big cooling slot on the back. I can only imagine what the thermal sort of dynamics for this machine are. It can support two additional 5K displays. So you've got the built-in 27-inch 5K display on the Mac itself, plus up to two additional 5K displays. And it is a beast of a machine. Now, as far as that upgradability goes, Apple did tell Rene Ricci over at iMore that the RAM on the iMac Pro can be upgraded post-purchase, but you need to have it done by an Apple store or by an Apple authorized service provider. So if you decide, hey, I got 32 gigs or 64 gigs and you suddenly want to upgrade to 128, sounds like you will be able to have an Apple authorized service center put in that RAM for you. Now the question becomes, could you do it yourself? Are there actually slots in there if you wanted to get in and do that? I would imagine that we're going to find out when iFixit does their teardown that that is the case. But if you're going to do that while you're under Apple care, it's probably going to void your warranty, considering the statement they made to Renee over at iMore. So you're probably not going to want to do it yourself. I would still go with the idea that configure that system exactly how you want it and are going to want it for the next 3 to 5 years, and don't worry about getting in there. Now, some early reviews and benchmarks attest to the performance gains over, say, a 2013 Mac Pro. The iMac Pro with the 10-core version, 3 gigahertz Intel Xeon, and the AMD Radeon Pro Vega graphics with 16 gigabytes of RAM, which will run you just under about $10,000 if you want that configuration. It's actually one of the recommended configurations from Apple. It gave a Geekbench multi-core score of just over 37,400, which puts it 45% faster than the highest end 2013 Mac Pro and about 95% faster than a high end 2017 27-inch 5K iMac. So these things are no slouches when it comes to performance, and early reviews are really, really good. The iMac Pro also comes with a black USB to Lightning cable. And along with the release of the iMac Pro, Apple also started selling its own branded Thunderbolt 3 cable, something we had not seen yet from Apple. The cable is a shorter one, about 0.8 meters or 2.62 feet, but it does enable speeds of up to 40 gigabits per second and provides power of up to 100 watts. It is $39 US in the price point and will be shipping December 18th. So if you want to get one of those along with your new iMac Pro, that's when it will be available. Now, along with the iMac Pro, or kind of to go along with the iMac Pro release, Apple also released updates, finally, to its full lineup of Pro apps, including Final Cut Pro, Motion, and Compressor. They've all been updated with a focus on editing full resolution 8K video, which a number of people have already noted the iMac Pro does very, very well with, just great performance and no loss in sort of real-time playback and dropping of frames or anything like that. It's supposed to be buttery smooth. They've also been updated for better support of 360 degree VR video, which is something that Apple is also pushing. And then the updates also finally bring support for HEVC and HEIF formats, Apple's new video and image formats that are supported by the latest iPhones. And that was something that the pros were waiting for a while, considering that the Photos app had already been updated and they were just kind of waiting for Apple to upgrade the Pro apps. And then Logic Pro 10 also received an update. It can now support up to 36 cores. So again, high performance on the Pro apps. If you're a Pro user, you're probably pretty excited about those updates finally coming this week. And as I mentioned, the iMac Pro may not be upgradable in terms of user upgradable components, but Apple also used the timing of the iMac Pro release to remind us, hey, there's more coming. They said, quote, Apple is working on a completely redesigned next generation Mac Pro, architected for Pro customers who need the highest performance, highest throughput system in a modular upgradable design, as well as a new high-end Pro display. So there is more to come. As far as when that is coming, of course, they did give us any more information related to that. So it could happen in 2018. It could happen later. We really don't know at this point, but we'll stay on top of that news and let you know as soon as we can when you can expect an updated Mac Pro. But that's all the latest on Apple's new Pro Max, and probably, I would imagine, the latest that we're going to hear about any Apple hardware updates through the end of the year. We're getting really close to the end of the year here, and I don't expect any more major announcements from Apple, at least with respect to new products. Based on a new investment this week, it looks like Apple is really banking that a big part of their future is going to be in freaking lasers. As part of its $1 billion pledge to invest in U.S. manufacturing via their Advanced Manufacturing Fund, Apple has announced a $390 million investment to a U.S. company called Finisar. Finisar makes vertical cavity surface emitting lasers, or vessel lasers, the kind that are used in Apple's iPhone X True Depth camera system, and also in the proximity sensors that are inside your AirPods. Actually, in the AirPods, that's the technology that detects when you remove an AirPod from your ear and then pauses the music. So those vessel lasers. Apple says it will be purchasing 10 times more vessel wafers in the fourth quarter of the year than were manufactured worldwide in the previous year. So Apple needs a lot of lasers, and that's what this investment in Finisar is about. In fact, Finisar came out and clarified after this report broke that the $390 million contribution is an agreed upon payment for anticipated future orders. So it's going to help them kind of build up their production facilities, and all of the vessels purchased by Apple from Finisar are going to be manufactured and made in Texas. The company is going to use the money to increase their R&D and production volumes to actually help meet Apple's future demands. They plan to hire more than 500 highly skilled employees at a new 700,000 square foot plant that they're building that's going to be 100% renewable energy powered. And that new facility is expected to go into operation sometime in the second half of 2018. Gene Munster also noted that the deal potentially locks up the supply for these kinds of lasers, making it harder for Apple's competitors to deploy similar technology. There's one other company, he says, that he knows of called Lumentum that makes these kinds of lasers, and they reportedly have suffered from manufacturing issues and have limited production. So by making this investment now, Apple not only locks in their pricing deals and can sort of maintain costs, but they also lock in supplies for the future. And as I noted, those future supplies are going to be large. We had heard that Apple was already looking at new laser technology or 3D laser sensor technology for future AR features in upcoming iPhones. There was a report that in 2019, Apple plans to use a laser-based system and time-of-flight data to drive depth sensing technology in the rear-facing EyeSight cameras. So they're going to switch from the kind of laser dot IR technology they're using today in the front-facing camera to this other kind of technology, at least for the rear-facing camera. And I have a feeling because lasers will go further distances, and also we talked about the fact that they can kind of better separate the different elements and provide a better experience in augmented reality. So those are going to be the similar kinds of laser technologies that need to go in there, and the partnerships with companies like Finisar are going to be critical for Apple's development of future products moving forward. So kind of a big investment, but seems like one that is perfectly in line with what Apple, has planned for the future. And then finally in the news for this week, we have more information about Apple's video content development or original content development. Apple Worldwide Video has reportedly hired Philip Matthies, formerly of Hulu, and Jennifer Wang Grazier of Legendary Entertainment. They both look like they will bring their experience and talent to Apple's original content video group to help them in securing future content deals. At Hulu, Matthies was responsible for deals and policies related to original shows and documentaries, and Grazier handles business and legal elements of development, production, and distribution for Legendary's TV and digital studios currently. Matthies started at Apple back in November, and Grazier is reportedly set to join the team in January. Both will be working directly under Zach Van Amberg and Jamie Ehrlich, formerly of Sony, who have been heading up Apple's Worldwide Video Group. So far as we know it, Apple has lined up two original content series already. One was based or is based on Steven Spielberg's Amazing Stories TV show from the 80s, and the other is going to be a drama about a morning show starring Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon. We've already talked about those two. This week, we also heard about a third original series, and it's now looking like it's probably going to be a space drama. Variety has reported that Ronald D. Moore, who worked on Star Trek as well as the new Battlestar Galactica, has been given the green light to create an unnamed sci-fi space drama for Apple. The piece says, quote, "The untitled series will take place in a world which the global space race never ended." So we don't know much more about that content. Beyond that, we do know the show is being co-developed by Fargo co-executive producers Matt Wolpert and Ben Nedivi, but we still also don't know much about how Apple plans to distribute their new shows. There has been some speculation that they're trying to put together a video streaming service to compete with things like Netflix and Amazon, although Apple themselves have said that their service is really, or what they're doing is really being set up to be complementary to those kinds of services. So I have to wonder if it's something that will be rolled out or maybe rolled into Apple's Apple Music subscription. I can't see just a handful of shows kind of being part of a whole new service, at least not something that's going to bring value unless they're bringing in other content from other sources. And we really just don't know at this point. All we do know is Apple is heavily investing in major talent, in major studio spaces, and getting pretty serious about grabbing up different shows. They've reportedly, as we've talked about on the show, set aside $1 billion in 2017 to acquire new content and create new shows. So they're getting pretty serious about it, and we're starting to see and hear about some of the fruits of that of those efforts. And I have to say, the three shows that they've announced so far sound pretty good and pretty exciting to me. I'm really looking forward to seeing what they put together, specifically the space drama, as I loved Battlestar Galactica. I thought it was a great series. And so if Ronald Moore can bring that kind of quality to a show at Apple or for Apple, that's going to be pretty awesome, and I'm looking forward to it. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, new sponsor here on the MacCast, and I'm super excited to have them on board. It is Backblaze, and you can imagine why I'm excited, because if you've listened to the show for any amount of time, you know I am fanatic about you doing backup. And as part of everyone's backup strategy, you should have some sort of online cloud storage. And if you're going to pick any company right now, I would say Backblaze are the people to go with. They offer unlimited cloud backup for Macs and PCs for just $5 a month. It is a great deal, a small price to pay to keep all your data safe online and protected from, you know, catastrophic things like fire or whatever kind of natural disaster could befall your computer, or theft. So you want to have a good online backup strategy, and Backblaze is a great one. It backs up your documents, your music, your photos, your videos, drawings, projects, everything. You can back up everything, including attached drives, which is really important. A lot of services don't offer that. They have mobile apps, so you can access all of your documents and files on the go, and they give you a number of ways to restore. You can restore just one file at a time. You can restore all your files directly, pulling them back offline. They also offer, and this is really important, restore by mail. If you have a complete system failure, you can actually purchase a hard drive through them with all your data on it and have it FedExed to you overnight. And if you return that drive within 30 days, you can get a full refund of that. So it's a total win-win. You can get all your data back and it won't cost you a thing if you use that drive return service. And I can't stress how important that is. I recently had to help someone recover their data from an online service because they unfortunately were in a fire and they weren't able to access their home or access the internet with any kind of good bandwidth, and the service they were using didn't offer restore by mail. You get that with Backblaze, and it's really important. Best of all, you can try it completely free for 15 days. You receive a fully featured 15-day trial if you go to backblaze.com/MacCast. So go there and give it a try. But I've been using Backblaze, and I've been super impressed with their application. It is faster than any other backup service that I've tried, and there's no noticeable impact. It just runs in the background. It does what it's supposed to do. Your stuff is getting backed up and secured, and it does it quickly and easily. I can't say enough about it. And something else I'll tell you is, it's the holiday time. A great thing to do would maybe be help a friend or family member by getting them set up with online backup through Backblaze as well. So don't just do it for yourself, do it for your friends and family. You really have no excuse now for not backing up your stuff. And don't forget about business backup. If you run a business and you already use Backblaze at home, tell your system administrator at work to go to backblaze.com/MacCast and just hit the business backup link at the top of the page, and you get the same awesome service with more admin tools and Backblaze groups and all kinds of things for managing your business backup. So make sure you visit backblaze.com/MacCast so they know where you came from and continue to support the show. And a big thank you to Backblaze for their support of the MacCast. On the last show, I mentioned that if you're concerned about the security of the data that's stored on your Mac, that one good option that you have is to enable File Vault on your Mac. And if you've been around for a while with the Mac, you know that File Vault in its early days kind of got a little bit of a bad reputation. But ever since File Vault 2, I feel pretty safe and comfortable recommending File Vault to anyone on their Mac. I've been using it for a number of years now, and it's worked great. I've had no issues running it once whatsoever. I know there are exceptions to that, and I've heard from some of you, so I know some people have run into problems, but I think those are few and far between. And again, I think if security is your priority with the data that's on your Mac, and if you really think about the kinds of things that we store on our Macs, like personal data, and you think about things like identity theft, especially if you have a laptop that you take out into the world with you where it could get lost or stolen, File Vault is generally a pretty good thing to have. And it's relatively easy to enable, right? Simply go into System Preferences, go into the Security tab, into Security and Privacy, rather, go to the File Vault tab, and just turn on File Vault. Now, when it walks you through that process, there's some important things to note, and we'll talk about some of those in a second. But after I mentioned File Vault on the last show, I got a couple of questions specifically from Bruce, and they were very common questions that I get when I start talking about File Vault. And his question was, will it interfere with my other backups, specifically Time Machine and Clone backups? And also, will those backups also be encrypted? And I have to tell you, Bruce, it really should not cause any day-to-day issues with anything on your system, including backups. Because when you log into your Mac, the system gains access to the keys and functionality that it needs for accessing a system, or a drive that is File Vault encrypted. So essentially, at that point, to the operating system, it is unlocked and it just functions normally. Everything is unlocked, all the files it has access to. And even when your system goes asleep and everything is locked, everything's going to continue to run normally. That includes online backups, Time Machine backups, and even your clone backups. It basically has full access to the unencrypted data on the drive once you've passed the initial login screen. Now, if you're wondering, well, how does that protect me if my Mac were to get lost or stolen? Well, if it has gone to the password screen, someone's not going to be able to hack or crack into your system. And the minute that they try to restart it, to reboot or something like that, all of the data is going to be re-encrypted and protected on the File Vault encrypted drive. So you're not going to have a problem with that. But because of the fact that once you've logged into your system or started up your Mac and logged in, the fact that the entire drive is not encrypted to the system, when you're running things like a clone backup or a Time Machine backup, by default, that backed up data is not encrypted. It's actually making an unencrypted copy of it back onto that external drive or that time machine drive. Now, if you want to protect those things, that you can, but you're going to have to enable File Vault protection on those by manually. You're going to have to select the option to actually do that. For Time Machine drives, it's relatively easy. You just go into System Preferences, into the Time Machine preferences, click the Select Disk option, and when you select your Time Machine disk, if it's not already encrypted, you'll see a checkbox that says Encrypt Backup Disk. If you check that option on, then it will apply File Vault encryption also to your Time Machine disk. For external drives that are not bootable, it's relatively easy to encrypt those as well. What you can do is you can right-click or control-click on the volume and choose the Encrypt option. It'll say encrypt and then the name of the volume. And if you choose that, that will apply File Vault encryption to that external volume. If you're using that drive, though, for a clone backup, I would say check with the manufacturer of your cloning software, be it SuperDuper or Carbon Copy Cloner, on the proper way to encrypt the drive. They may have some caveats or some things that they want you to do, especially if you're using that external clone backup as a bootable backup. You have to perform some of the encryption options in a very specific way. So check those for the software that you're using. Don't just do the thing in the Finder because you might run into problems, especially if you're trying to boot off of that volume. So I want to be very clear about that. A few other notes about enabling File Vault encryption. When you turn on File Vault for the first time, you're going to have to choose how you want to be able to unlock your startup disk if you ever forget your password. So by default, when you turn on File Vault, it's going to be the login username and password that you use for logging into your Mac. Now, if you somehow forget that information, File Vault, when you turn it on, asks you to give it an extra option or a secondary way to get into that drive so you don't get yourself in trouble. The default is to use your iCloud account and password. If you choose that option, then you'll be able to use your iCloud information, your iCloud login, to actually gain access to your Mac as a backup. The other option is to have a recovery key generated for you. That key will be given to you and displayed if you select that option, and you need to take that and store that in a secure place, say in a password manager like 1Password, and you don't want to forget that recovery key, because if you choose that option, that is your only way in should you ever forget your login for your Mac. You won't be able to fall back to the iCloud option. It's one or the other, so I want to be very clear about that. But bottom line is, do not ever forget your recovery option. So if you choose the recovery key, you don't want to lose that. If you choose the iCloud account option, you never want to forget your iCloud login. If you do any of that, you're going to be in real trouble when you turn File Vault on and you forget the login information for your Mac and your recovery key backup option, because at that point, you are not going to be able to reset anything. You're going to basically have to erase your volume and start over from scratch. And if you've encrypted your backups with File Vault, Time Machine, and your clone backups, guess what? You're not going to get access to those either. So these are all things to think about when you're enabling File Vault encryption. So I guess the point is you can get yourself into trouble with File Vault, but as far as the underlying technology itself, I don't think you're going to run into any issues with that. It's just going to be, if you're a forgetful person, make sure you put that information, write it down, put it in a password manager, you know, put it in a secure place. But with that, you should be totally fine. And like I said, I've been using File Vault for a number of years now, and it's awesome. I know that my data is secure and protected, and it never on a day-to-day basis gives me any trouble. I haven't noticed any performance issues. That's another question I'll get asked about. Well, does it slow down your machine because it's doing all this encryption? No, I mean, initially it will, as it encrypts the volume, it happens over, I think, a couple days, and in the background, depending upon the size of your internal hard drive. But once it's done, no, on a day-to-day basis, really no performance issues. You're not going to notice it at all. You're going to continue to use your Mac just as if it were an unencrypted drive and not using File Vault. So that's my opinion on it. Again, I know some of you have had different experiences. If you want to share your experiences with us, shoot us an email or an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. Now I want to talk a little bit about Apple support, and specifically like hardware support, and just some changes and some things that I've noticed over the last couple years. And it's somewhat stuff that's supported by comments that you have made to me as well. And what has triggered me wanting to talk to you about this is I had an issue about a week and a half ago with my Apple Watch Series 2. I've had it for a while. It is obviously out of Apple Care at this point, but went to put it on the other day. And actually, I should back up a little bit, because about 3 weeks ago or so, I noticed when I was putting it on that the area around the screen where it sort of blends into the bezel, I started to notice a little bit of a seam. And I thought, wow, that's odd. I never really noticed that before, that there was a seam there. And it just wasn't as flush as it was initially, or at least that's what I thought. And then I thought, well, maybe I'm just crazy. Maybe I just never noticed it before, because it was really minor. You had to look really closely to see this sort of little gap or this little bump that had formed where the two materials met. And I didn't think much about it, and kind of went on and went, okay, just something there, and I just never noticed it. Fast forward to about a week and a half ago, and I'm going to put my Apple Watch on in the morning and go to unlock it, touch the screen, and blink, the screen completely falls out of the frame. Now, it's totally functioning. Everything's working, but it's just sort of dangling there by the little cable. And I can see the Taptic engine and the Apple logo. I can see the battery. I can see everything underneath. But the screen has just popped out. And so what has obviously happened, or at least obvious to me, is that the glue that holds in the display has just failed. Something has happened. It has lost its stickiness or something like that. And I happen to know by checking on iFixit that it's just like a little 3M tape strip that's put on there during manufacturing that holds that display in place. So it's not anything technically, you know, really complicated, but I thought, oh, that's really odd. It shouldn't do that. You know, it shouldn't just fail after a couple years, that this little glue strip. And I thought, well, you know, I'll contact Apple. I'll see what they want to do. So I made a Genius Bar appointment. I took the watch in. The Genius looked at it, assessed the situation, said, yeah. And as a matter of fact, he even looked at it, looked at the battery and said, oh, your battery has swollen. And that's what's popped out the screen. That's why you're having this problem. So because it's the battery, we're going to go ahead and cover the repair. No problem. We just need to send it into the repair depot. And you'll have it back in a couple days. So I thought, great, they're handling it. Send it in the repair depot, let it go. And a couple days go by, and I get an email from the Apple repair depot, and they say, oh, we took a look at your watch. The battery is not swollen. And because the battery is not swollen, we're not going to cover this repair. It's going to be $250. To repair the Apple Watch, which is the standard out of warranty repair cost. It's a flat rate cost. It's kind of how Apple does things now. And I know that technically I'm way past my 1 year of complimentary Apple Care, because normally, because the screen popping out was just a manufacturing defect, it would be covered under the standard Apple Care warranty. I didn't buy Apple Care Plus on my Apple Watch. And so technically Apple has no obligation to really cover this repair. But at the same time, there's a principle of it, right? This is a $600 watch. It's a premium product. It has failed, obviously due to a manufacturing defect after a couple years. And we're talking about a glue strip, a 3M sticky pad, that's the entire repair. So you put the sticky pad in, you pop the screen back in, the repair is done. I can't fathom or understand how this repair could cost $250 for Apple to do. I get that repair depot time, you know, the engineer's time, the person who's having to do the repair is going to take a couple hours, maybe. I can't imagine it takes more than an hour, but let's say even a couple hours, and they need to get paid, and there's shipping, and there's all that stuff, fine. But $250 just seems excessive to me. So I decide I'm going to call back and try and see what they do. And of course, I call back, I get first tier support, I start talking to them. They toe the party line with Apple. Hey, it's out of Apple Care. You need to cover the cost. This is the cost. There's nothing we can do about that. And so I have to make the call and say, you know what? I want to go to the next level of support. And I have to demand and ask that they send me to second tier support. They do offer to do that after I request it. I'm given to an advisor who is very nice. Again, this whole time, they're being very professional, very nice, no big issues there. But, you know, I'm having to sort of fight for what I feel is just something basic. Like, this is something that should be covered. And eventually, I get to that person. He says, okay, I've noted what's going on. I need to run this up the chain. I need to see if I can get approval on this. Give me a couple days and I'll get back to you. A couple days go by. He gets back to me and tells me, hey, we're going to go ahead and make a one-time exception on this. We will do the repair, and you should have your Apple Watch back in a couple days. So I'm still waiting to get my Apple Watch back, and they are going to do it. But what I wanted to really talk to you about is this idea that it seems like this is a process we didn't have to do in years past, especially for this kind of repair, where it's not user-inflicted damage. It's just simply a defect of, you know, a high-end premium product. And more these days, it seems like a lot of Apple's hardware is failing and having little issues. And again, I recognize that this is technology. These sorts of things happen. And I hate playing what I call the, you know, Steve card. If Steve were around, this would be different. But more and more, it just feels to me like that's kind of what's happening. I don't know. And I'm having trouble making that leap, but it feels like we're in an area where several things have gone downhill for Apple. And I'm struggling with how to understand or deal with it beyond trying to go to that place where we're saying, Apple is doing poorly. They've lost their edge. They're not taking care of their customers like they used to. It's feeling like that's what's going on. And here's kind of the things that I've seen. The attention to the small details seem to keep being missed. And we see it kind of happening over and over again. If we look at all of the security issues we've had over the past couple of weeks. Now, Phil Schiller came out and said, hey, you know, this is just Apple having a bad week. And that may be the case, you know, because these were kind of three or four incidents that kind of happened back to back, or there were other bugs like the texting bug. But to me, those seem like little small details, and some of them actually big details. But, you know, let's go with the texting bug, right? A small little niggly thing that normally wouldn't be a big deal, but in aggregate, it starts to look kind of like a big deal. And we seem to keep having these things happen, these little details that are getting missed that, again, maybe my memory's bad or maybe my history's bad. I don't think it is, but don't seem to have been getting missed in the past. We have had continued poor quality products. I'm going to point to the number of models of MacBook Pro that have had video issues. I have dealt with three of them in the past, you know, three different models, the 2011 MacBook Pro, the 2010 MacBook Pro, and also my iBook. I know that's going way back in history, so maybe we don't count that one, but at least two of those MacBook Pro models. And again, premium, higher end Pro products. This is, you know, a $3,000 computer. We're not talking about a $500 computer here. You have that. You have the new MacBook Pros that are having the massive keyboard issues for a lot of people. This is serious, where the keyboard just literally stops working because a crumb gets under a key or a speck of dust, and people are having to deal with that, going through multiple repairs and dealing with that stuff. So it seems like quality level of the products is not as good as it used to be in the past. And again, the pricing hasn't changed, but the products don't seem to be holding up at the same level. And finally, and I think the biggest thing that I'm struggling with is this customer service side of things. The number of times over the past few years that I felt like Apple had been putting its bottom line ahead of customer satisfaction. So towing the hard line on AppleCare, even when you hit a point where the product obviously has a manufacturing defect. It's not a user-inflicted damage. It is, hey, there's something seriously wrong with this product. And I'm not saying that we're at this place where, hey, Apple is doomed. It's doomsday. This is really bad. I think Apple ultimately will do the right thing. But it feels like more and more that it's not just happening by default, that customers are having to push back on Apple. We're having to put together petitions. We're having to send more comments to apple.com/feedback. We're having to go into the Genius Bar and say, I need to talk to a supervisor. I need to escalate my issue because I'm not getting the kind of service that I feel I should be getting for the kind of product that I'm buying. And I think just the general uncertainty of what's going on with Apple right now is a bad feeling. It's not a good feeling. I'm not having the number of good feelings that I've had about Apple in the past. And that makes me a little bit sad. It makes me a little bit frustrated. And I don't know why or really what to do about it, which is probably why I'm talking to you about it and wondering, am I crazy? Are you feeling the same things? You know, I feel like Apple is training me to, when I have a problem, have to prepare to battle, to fight for my rights, to stand up and force them to stand behind their products. And I don't think that's good for me. I don't think that's good for Apple. And I don't think it's good for their brand. And I have to be honest, it frustrates me a little bit. Maybe it's good for their shareholders because they're saving money. And I'm one of the shareholders too. But I can tell you, as a shareholder, I don't like it. I don't, you know, Apple's big thing was they cared about deeply, deeply about the quality of their products. I think they still do care about the quality of the products, but the actions and sort of the oversight of that, I think, is failing a little bit. And they always used to put customer satisfaction ahead of everything. And I definitely feel like that mantra has changed. And I don't know if that's under the direction of Angela Ahrens or if it's Tim Cook. But ultimately, I think the buck stops at Tim Cook. So, and he's well known as being a numbers guy. And so maybe that's where some of it's coming from. I don't think that's the intent. I don't think the result that's happening is the intent. Again, I think Apple deeply cares about their products. I still think they deeply care about their customers. But once again, I think that idea, that ideology, while it's believed, I don't think the company's operating or making actions or decisions in a way that are necessarily reflecting that. And I don't understand why, because we're hearing one thing from the executives and the people at the top, but we're seeing a different result in terms of the products and the experience that we're getting with Apple. And I don't know where that disconnect comes from or happens, but it does feel like a disconnect that didn't happen in the past. And you know, I don't know. I just wanted to share those thoughts with you. I'd love to know what you think about this. I don't want to turn this thing into an Apple bashing session, and hopefully I didn't do that here, because that certainly wasn't my intent. I'm still very much an Apple customer. I still very much love Apple and believe in their products and what they're doing. But I also think they could be doing better, and I want them to do better, and I want to see if there's a way that maybe we can influence that and maybe we can get back to that state. And maybe it hasn't been lost. Maybe you're going to tell me I'm crazy and you're not having that same experience. But let me know. Send me some feedback and some comments. maccast@gmail.com. Here's one little thing, though, I think we can maybe complain about related to Apple and specifically updates. Dan wrote in to ask me to have the community provide feedback to Apple to say, hey, can we stop having the kind of forceful nudging, maybe even nagging about doing operating system updates both on iOS and on the Mac? And if you're one of those people that likes to hold off on updating, you don't want to update to, say, macOS High Sierra day one, or maybe you don't want to jump to iOS 11 right on day one, you know what I'm talking about, right? You get those notifications almost daily, almost weekly, even when you say, no, don't let me know about this update. I don't want to know. You get that alert, right? Hey, you haven't updated yet. Are you sure you don't want to update? You want to update now? Are you sure you don't want to update? Yeah, it's maybe not that bad, but you know what I'm talking about, right? And so Dan was saying, hey, we should all be going to apple.com/feedback and say, hey, can you at least give us the option to opt out of those updates or turn them off? And let's be honest, there really isn't a good way, especially on iOS, to stop those reminders once they started. Now, you could cut them off at the pass, but unfortunately, that also disables maybe some updates that you want. But I want to share with you how you can maybe avoid some of those notifications if you choose to. So before you get the very first notification on iOS, what you could do is you could go into settings, into iTunes and App Store, and simply turn off the updates option. Like I said, the problem with this is that means it turns off all updates, meaning that you're gonna have to manually go in for your apps and check for updates. If you've already been getting some of those iOS 11 updates, you're going to also need to go in and remove the already downloaded update. What a lot of people don't know is when you're getting those notifications, those are triggered by the update mechanism, the auto update mechanism, already downloading the installer for iOS 11 in the background if you're running, say, iOS 10. So you're going to have to go into Settings, General, iPhone storage or iPad storage, depending upon your device, and then find the latest update that is in there. It's probably going to be downloaded, already installed, and it'll look like something like iOS 11.2.1 or 2 or whatever it might be. And you're going to have to tap on that and then tap the delete option to remove that. And a message will come up. You'll need to verify that you want to delete it. And then once it's deleted, you shouldn't get any more. If you've turned off the updates, you shouldn't get any more of those notifications. And so you can see on iOS, you can kind of turn those off. Now, one other thing I want to let you know about with those notifications, specifically on iOS, is you need to be aware or beware of the install tonight option. And I know some people have gotten hit by this. My wife got hit by it one time. It will pop the notification saying, hey, there's a new iOS update. Do you want to install it? You say install later. And then you get to another dialogue that says install tonight or install later. So you have to tap install later again to delay the notification, not have the update installed. If you hit install tonight by accident and enter in your passcode, what it does is it schedules the update to automatically install the next time your device is connected to power and it runs overnight. So if you're connected to power and Wi-Fi, it'll run overnight. And in the morning when you wake up, suddenly you'll have the new operating system installed. And I know many people that have been bit by that. So beware of that specifically on iOS. And again, I don't think turning off updates completely is ideally what we want to do, but if you want to avoid that nagging, that's about the only option that I know of that you can do without getting into kind of some serious hacking. On macOS, what you can do a lot of people don't know is you can hide the update in the Mac App Store. So if you open up the Mac App Store, for example, with macOS High Sierra, and you see that macOS High Sierra banner, you can control or right-click on that banner, and you will see a hide update option. If you hide the update, you will not get the notifications on your Mac to upgrade to High Sierra. Now, after that, you're not going to see that banner page anymore when you go into the App Store, so you're going to have to, when you are ready to upgrade, search the Mac App Store for macOS High Sierra update, and then install it from there. So you're going to have to, again, manually go in and install it. But what's nice about this option is it only hides that one update, the macOS High Sierra update. It's not going to disable or hide your other updates. You could go in and completely disable automatic updates for the Mac App Store. That would have the same effect. Go into System Preferences, into App Store, and uncheck the automatically check for updates option. But again, that's going to get rid of all of your update checks, and maybe that's not what you want to do. Now, you could try also just disabling the download newly available updates in the background, but that's going to essentially have almost the same effect. So you can play around with the settings in there, but I don't think that's ultimately what you want to do. I think the easiest way on macOS is to simply hide the update for the latest OS update. And one other thing you may or may not know, even if you have not updated to macOS High Sierra yet, there's good odds that your Sierra Mac, your Mac running macOS Sierra, has already downloaded the installer for macOS High Sierra, and it's sitting on your hard drive, taking up about 5 gigabytes of space. So if you haven't updated yet, you might want to go in and look inside your applications folder and look for a little application called Install macOS High Sierra. And if you see that in there, that's the High Sierra installer. It downloaded in the background because of your settings for the Mac App Store on your Mac, and it's just sitting there waiting to install. So you may also want to remove that to free up about 5 gigabytes of your disk space. But that's some options to maybe help with the little nagging update thing. I do think Apple or Dan's original advice is probably some good advice. You know, just politely go in and tell Apple, hey, can we at least just have an option, a toggle that says, do not notify me or do not give me notifications about operating system updates? Because, you know, we want to decide when we want to update. And yeah, we know the new version's out. We don't want to be bothered by it. I think that's not too much to ask. So I think that's good advice, Dan. And I will probably be going in and giving that feedback to Apple. And maybe if enough of us do, they'll give us an option to disable that. Hey, I've got some cool Safari tips and tricks for you specifically related to long press shortcuts. And remember, a long press on iOS is a press and hold. So don't do it with any force. It's not a force press, but if you tap and hold on an item, that's what Apple calls a long press. And I'm going to give a tip of the hat and link to a piece over at 9to5Mac. Benjamin Mayo actually put together this list, and I thought it was such a great list, I really wanted to share these tips with you. So credit to him for pointing this out, and I thought these were some really great ones. So all of them involve the long press in Safari on iOS. So if you long press the forward or back buttons in Safari, you get a history of pages that you've been to or navigated back from, depending upon whether you're hitting the forward or back buttons. So you can long press on there, and rather than just going backwards one page at a time, you can actually hold that down and get a list and then jump to any one of the pages that you had been to previously. I use that one all the time. Great time saver. And a lot of these, that's what this is all about, is sort of saving you time and extra taps when you're using Safari on iOS. The bookmarks icon, if you long press on that, you get options to quickly add a bookmark or add an item to your reading list. And that's a lot quicker than the normal way a lot of people do it, which is going through the share button. With the share button, you got to tap share. You got to find the add bookmark option. You got to tap that. So with the long press, you can kind of do it all without having to leave the main sort of Safari screen. Similarly, if you long press on the tab button, you get options for closing a tab, closing all of your tabs, adding a new tab, or even a new private tab. And if you're on the iPad, you'll get options for moving into or out of split view with tabs. So with the latest version of iOS on the iPad, you can actually do split screen Safari, where you have a browser on each side of the screen. So you have two up browsing when you're in landscape mode, which is really nice and a great convenience. When you're managing your tabs, so when you actually tap on the tab button and you're in the little screen where you can manage your tabs, you can press and hold on the add tab button, the little plus symbol, to view your recently closed tabs. So if you've closed some tabs and you want to maybe get back to those or can't remember what tabs you've closed, you can do that. I think on the iPad, the plus symbol is actually on the main screen next to the tab button. So you don't have to go into the manage tab screen first. You can actually just tap and hold on that little plus symbol. Another thing you can do when you're in that tab management screen where you see all of your tabs open, if you long press on the done button in that whole tab overview, you can get options to close all of your tabs. So rather than having to close them one by one, you can actually close all of them from there. And again, iPad users are also going to see an option to open split view or to merge the tabs from your split view if you already have split view active. So that's a nice little time saver there. Couple things when you're just browsing around inside Safari. If you long press on a hyperlink, any hyperlink, you get some additional options. One of the things that you get is you get a little sheet that pops up that will give you the full URL. So if you're wondering what URL sits behind that link on a page, that's great for checking a link for spamminess. If it's going to be something that's going to take you maybe someplace you don't want to go, that will reveal that to you. So it's a safer way of clicking on a link. And then you also in that same sheet get some additional options for one, opening the link in a new tab, adding it to your reading list, copying the link, or going into the share options for that link. So if you want to send that link as an iMessage, something like that, you can do that that way. If you long press on an image in a web page, you get some similar options, including being able to view the full URL, but you also get the open in new tab, add to reading list, copy, share, and save image options. So if you want to save an image to your camera roll, you can do that by long pressing on the image in a web page. If you long press on an icon in the favorites view, you can then get options to delete a favorite or to edit a favorite. So if you want to change the URL, you can do that. If you long press on the reload icon in the URL bar in Safari, this is really handy. You can request the desktop version of a site. So by default on most iOS devices, you're getting the view of an iOS optimized version or a mobile optimized version of that web page. If you want to actually see the full desktop page, which might have some additional options or look differently, just long press on the reload button in the URL bar and you'll see a request desktop site option. And if you use a content blocker on iOS, long pressing on the reload icon also gives you the options to reload the page without the content blocker in effect. So if you wanted to temporarily disable content blocking on that page, you do that with a long press on the reload icon. And then finally, long pressing on the reader button. This is a new one in iOS 11, but probably my favorite feature of iOS 11 because I love the reader view. For those of you who don't know about Reader View, when you're on a web page, most likely some sort of article, either on a blog or on a news website, if you look up in the URL bar on the left-hand side, you'll see a bunch of little lines. If you tap on that, what that does is that gives you a reader view of that web page. So just the text and images, none of the ads, none of the banners, none of the extra extraneous stuff. It gives you a clean reading view of that article. Well, starting with iOS 11 and macOS Sierra, or the latest versions of Safari browser, rather, you can default certain websites or all websites to use the reader view if it's available. And the way you do that for a website is on iOS, is in Safari, when you're on the site, long press on that little reader button, and you can choose to always load pages on that website in Reader View, or you can also choose to load all websites using Reader View if they have a Reader View available. And it is super handy. I'm using it on a number of my favorite news websites, and it's great to be able to click a link in my Twitter app and then have that page open in Safari, but with a nice clean view for just reading the article and just getting at the content without all the ads and all the extra stuff that's on there. So I think that's really great and a great new feature of iOS Safari. And there you go. There's a bunch of really great long press tricks that maybe you didn't know before. One other little quick tip related to Safari and storage on iOS. You know, when you're browsing websites, they're caching data, they're downloading information, they're storing it, and it gets stored locally temporarily in the cache so that if you go back to that website, the website loads more quickly. Well, depending upon the website, that can be, you know, potentially a lot of data. And if you're browsing a lot, that can be a lot of storage that's being eaten up on your device. And especially if you have a smaller device with less storage, say 16 gigabytes or 32 gigabytes, that may end up being a significant amount of storage. And maybe you want to get some of that back. Well, you can do that by cleaning up Safari's website data. To do that, you go into settings on your iOS device, into Safari, scroll all the way down to the bottom, and you'll see an advanced option. Tap on that and then tap on website data. Wait a couple seconds, it's going to load different websites and they're going to show you how much cache and local data they're using. And it will start with the site that's using the most data. For me and probably for most of you, that's going to be Google. It uses quite a bit of data. It'll be at the top and then it will list all of the websites, you know, going down by the amount of data that it's using up. And I think by default, it shows you the first 10 or 12 sites. I can't remember. And then you can tap the show all sites if you want to see all of the websites. But in that list, if you swipe right to left across an entry, or if you hit edit or tap the edit option, you will get delete options to be able to delete that data. And you tap on delete and then confirm that you want to remove that data from the website, and it will clean up that data and get you back that storage. Now, be aware that if you remove this data, or the data that's being removed is all of the data for that website. You can't selectively decide which data you want to remove. So that includes things like cookies and login tokens, session information, and all that stuff. So you are going to lose any saved logins. So if you've gone to a website on iOS and you've checked that box, yeah, I want to save my login, that will be, or auto log me into this website, that will be wiped out, and you're going to have to log into that website again. Now, if you've saved the username and password for that inside Safari, that data is not removed. It will autofill that information in again, if you're using the keychain in Safari and on iOS, that should still be there. It's just the local data for that website, cookies and stuff like that, are not going to be. So you will find yourself logged out, and you're going to have to log back into that website. So be aware of that when you're removing this option. There's also an option at the bottom of that screen to remove all website data. That's going to remove the cache and data for every website that you visit. So you can either do it selectively site by site, or you can remove all of it and free up all of that storage. And incidentally, this is how you would quote unquote clear the cache in Safari on iOS. So if somebody's ever told you, hey, clear the cache for the website, or clear the cache because it's loading a not updated version of the website, this is how you can do it. Go into Settings, Safari Advanced, Website Data, find the website that you want to clear the cache for, and do it from there. So there you have it, a couple cool little tips and tricks for Safari on iOS. Last thing I have for you today is kind of a cool little thing of the moment. It's a game specifically for iPhone X users that lets you use your face as the controller for the game. Yeah, it relies on the true depth camera system and face detection to be able to actually play the game. And the way it works, or I guess it should give you the name of the game, it's called Rainbrow, and the name comes from the fact that you control the game with your eyebrows. So you use your eyebrows to move a little icon up and down on the screen. So you lift your eyebrows up to move the character up, you use a plain expression to have the character stay still, and you furrow your eyebrows to have your character move down. And basically what you have is you have a little face emoji that is moving across rainbow colored areas on the screen, going from the bottom to the top of the screen. And so you're moving your character, the little emoji icon, up and down, trying to collect stars that appear in the different zones on the screen. And in each one of those zones, there's another emoji that's moving right to left across the screen. I think right to left, they might be moving in both directions, but there's emoji moving across those areas, and you're trying to avoid those emoji and collect as many stars as you can. And the minute you hit any one of the bad emojis, the game is over, and that is the score you get. So it's a very simple game. I will say that while playing the game is very challenging and fun, it's even funner to watch someone else playing the game, because they're making these facial contortions to control this little thing going up and down the screen, and it's kind of hilarious, and it's just a lot of fun. So it's a free little app on the App Store. If you're an iPhone X user, it's making innovative use of the facial detection technology, and it's a lot of fun. So, you know, it's not going to win any major awards. I don't think it's going to become the next big thing. Maybe it will. But certainly fun to check out, and I wanted to bring it up to you because I just came across it just today. So it's called Rainbrow, and I will link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, or you can just search Rainbrow on the Mac App Store. And it's not rainbow, it's Rainbrow. So a little play on words because you're controlling it with your eyebrows. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label. Also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all of their great software and applications by going to smilesoftware.com macgeeks.com/podcasts. And I'd also like to thank the supporters of the MacCast, the 131 of you who are direct supporters of the show through Patreon. The Patreon campaign has been going great. You can check it out at patreon.com/MacCast. And I really do appreciate those of you who have signed up and pledged to support the show. We have a couple of great goals and things that we're trying to reach. We need just 3% of you, 3% of the audience, to pledge at least $1 a month to reach our goal, our user group goal. And what that is I would like to host a quarterly live meeting with members of the MacCast community where we pick a topic, we go in depth on it, we talk about it, we live stream it, we have a chat. And for those of you who couldn't make the live stream, we'll go ahead and capture the video and put out a quarterly user group meeting. And if we can reach that pledge level, that's going to let us buy the software and get the technology we need to make all of that happen. Basically, I'm going to need a service where we can have a face-to-face meeting with a bunch of people in the group. So that's the plan, and that's a really achievable goal because just 3% of the audience has to give $1 to reach that goal. So we've started off, we've got 131 awesome people pledging to the show. I'd love to have you pledging as well. We've got some great rewards for you in there, including a membership card that's going to give you some benefits at a certain level. And, you know, there's going to be some cool swag that we're going to send out for those who support at the $10 level. So check out all of the ways that you can support the show directly by going to patreon.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to everyone who's supported so far. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, and you can leave a voicemail there for me. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me online between shows, you can check out all of our social media pages. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if you prefer Google Plus, the Google Plus community is at google.com/MacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.